G'day, my name's Han. I'm a tropical fruit farm near Darwin. I grow mangoes, jackfruit, pomelos, and jumper nut, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand, and welcome to a special broadcast of The Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio program. We are celebrating 70 years in 2015. Today's show is coming to you from a crocodile farm on the outskirts of Darwin in the Northern Territory. The Top End, and this idea of developing the North. It's back in the headlines this year with the federal government releasing a white paper and talking about spending millions and millions of dollars up this way on roads and water infrastructure. They want to unlock the North, create a gateway to Asia. But I don't know, have we heard all of this before? I can promise you, ladies and gentlemen, that we will not have any politicians on the program today. Instead, we will be speaking to some of the successful farmers of Northern Australia who have been up this way for decades. They love what they do, and they're making a few good dollars. They're doing all right for themselves. What are their tips to running a successful agribusiness in Northern Australia? And what are their thoughts on Northern development? And it is lunchtime right across Australia. And so we've got the barbecue cranking. My mate, Captain Carl Curtin, is right next to the hot plate. What's on the sizzle, Carl?
It's sizzling away here, Matt. We've got buffalo sausages, we've got ramen steak right in the Top End, and we've even got some crocodile satay.
Croc, buffalo, and ramen. How good does that sound for lunchtime right across the country on ABC local radio? We've set ourselves up in a really nice spot next to a pen, which I've been told has 536 crocodiles in it. A few of them are swimming in the water, but most of them, I've got to say, have come up onto the bank and have got a prime position for today's Country Hour. They're big Country Hour fans, or they like the look of what's on the barbecue. Anyway, good to have them involved. Crocodiles Park, that's where we are this afternoon. Crocodiles, they're legends of the Top End. I mean, we can barely go swimming around here because of them, but we love them. They're legends. They're icons of Northern Australia. Thousands of tourists make their way to the Northern Territory each year to get a look at these guys. And, of course, their skins, well, they can be worth a small fortune for those involved in high-end fashion. Graham Webb is from Crocodiles Park, and he joins us now. Graham.
Hi, mate.
These crocodiles here in the pond, mate, how long does it take to turn them into handbags?
They'll be about another year, I think, and they'll be the size to put through the abattoir and turn into skins and meat.
There's over 500 of them in the pond. How do you get them out?
Well, actually, it used to be with great difficulty, but now it's not so much that you drop the water and they use now, instead of having to rope each individual crocodile and struggle it, they use a little electric stunner that just goes gzzzt and that croc's immobilised. And so it just makes it quick and efficient, and you don't get the animals getting stressed and you don't get the people getting bitten. So it's a wonderful invention.
The crocodile industry in the Northern Territory is on the rise. It's expanding and expanding. What's driving that growth?
Well, you know, for a long time, when you look at it, I was involved, I guess, in the very start when the first farm started here in 1979. And it went through a period of sort of lethargy. But then I guess what's happened over the last 10 to 15 years, some new players have come in and really got behind the expansion of the industry to its capacity, and or not to its capacity, but its potential. And so it has. It's grown up. It's now generating something like, you know, $25 million a year, which is big for us up here.
And just last week, the industry announced a plan to double the value of the industry in just 5 years' time. How are you going to achieve that?
Well, I think it's going to happen, as they said when they released that they're really looking at ways now of extending, like, sort of satellite farms out into remote Aboriginal communities. So instead of the people being able to just sell eggs or hatchlings to the farming industry, they're going to be able to raise them to the next stage and take it as many stages as they want. But so that'll be part of it. Part of it will be in increased numbers. Part of it will be in the ever-increasing demand for high quality. The skin thing has changed.
How do you get a skin from here near Darwin to the runways of Milan and the fashion houses of Europe?
Well, it's... The skin of the saltwater crocodile is recognised as one of the best skins, partly because of its pattern of scales, but here in the north, it's even better. So these are considered the best skins for a variety of reasons. So that people,
how do you get them over there? Do you fly them?
Yeah, most of them go by air.
Yep.
And they're used mainly by the very big fashion companies that really... They're a brand name, iconic. They sell them for a lot, and they pay the highest prices. Mm. And when you hear at the farming end, looking up at the price of a Hermes handbag or something, you think, oh, wow. You know. But when you're at the other end, and they're trying to sell it, and everyone's got to get their cut, it suddenly makes sense. So.
With the croc industry and running a farm in Darwin, When you hear on the news talks of developing the north, for you as a scientist, as a croc farmer, and as a bit of a conservationist, what do you hope happens next?
Well, you know, it's the whole concept of developing the north's not new. You know, this all happened in the 1800s when they were selling the land to Britain. You know, everyone was going to develop the north, and it was going to be the gateway to Asia. So there's still a long way to go, I think, before we're really going to achieve that. But I went over to the opening this, and I was actually impressed by the sort of commitment that seemed to be there by the current government to really get behind developing the north, because we're stuck. You know, we're miles from anywhere. You know, we're in a remote area, and that hasn't changed. And, you know, it's hard for people to carry on normal business activities in a remote area. You can't get access often to competitive prices.
So you want to see services?
Well, yeah. Look, I'd like to see about 4 new aircraft coming up a day, you know, because July was just ridiculous. People would miss a plane in Sydney and they'd be charged. You know, I know 4 people that were then quoted $1,800 to $2,500 for a single return fare, a single fare to Darwin the next day because the services aren't there. That's what kills us a bit, you know, that we're still remote.
Just finally and very quickly, Carl's on the barbecue trying to cook crocodile kebabs. What's the secret to cooking crocodile meat well?
Don't cook it too long.
Hear that, Carl?
2 minutes.
He's cooked it too long. I can tell from his face. He's stuffed it. Graham Webb, thanks for your time on the Country
That's
Hour.
That's okay. It's a pleasure.
You're listening to the Country Hour, broadcasting right across Australia today as part of our special series celebrating 70 years of Australia's longest running radio program. You can follow us via Twitter and the hashtag #IdMoveNorthIf. So if you're listening down south today, we're keen to know, what would it take for you to get out of the cold, pack the bags, pack up the family and move to the north? Let us know via Twitter and the hashtag #IdMoveNorthIf. Now, our next guest, well, he actually used to be a dairy farmer in Victoria. He moved up north and he now runs cattle and he does a little bit of rice as well on Mount Kepler Station, which is on the Adelaide River. Bruce White, welcome to the Country Hour. Tell us, why did you move up north?
Oh, one of the reasons is 20 years ago we bought the station up north because I thought there was great opportunities being close to Asia. There's a lot of people in Asia, a growing economy, so I thought, wow, a lot of opportunities there for people to grow cattle or whatever, cropping, anything like that up the north.
What did your friends think when you left the dairy to move north?
Oh, probably some thought I was quite mad. But I knew I was getting out of a cold climate into a nice warm climate, and I tell you what, I just love the warm weather. And so do the rest of the family. Some congratulated us, said it was a brave move. Well, it was probably brave. But mind you, we did own the station 10 years before we actually sold our dairy farm and shifted north.
How have you made it work?
Oh, we're still trying to make it work. We run cattle, and that's our prime income. We're experimenting with rice. A friend of ours said, why don't you grow rice up here? And I thought, well, that's a good idea. We had a dam not getting utilised, and we were growing rye. And the country below the dam was floodplain, which is virtually useless for cattle feed, very low nutrition. So we decided we'll give it a go, and we've been doing it for 5 years now, and every year there's a new challenge. But
like what? Give us some of your classics.
Oh, well, the first year a friend gave us 300 kilos of rice, and we grew it. We thought, oh, we'd grow sorghum as well as rice. Well, the wallabies came in and they ate the sorghum and they ate the rice. And then we started to realise you just can't grow two together. And then we thought, some of the department fellas said, well, laser it. So we lasered the country and that solved that problem. And then we were able to grow the rice successfully. But then
you've had crocodiles in the paddies?
Oh, yeah, we've got crocodiles.
Crocs in the paddies?
Yeah, we had a crocodile this year in the paddy, and we've got three buffalo that keep getting in, and we keep chasing them out, and next time they won't come back again.
Can I ask, do you think rice could be a big crop for the north?
Oh, look, there's got a lot of floodplain, especially around the Adelaide River area, and it's virtually useless for nothing. It's got a good clay base and a sandy loam on top. I think it could be. It just, we have to get a right variety to develop in the subtropical areas, so I think that's very important.
Do you miss the dairy days?
Don't miss getting out of bed in the cold, but I do miss the cash flow. every month we got paid. And another interesting thing about dairying compared with running a cattle property and playing with rice that we do up here is that we only have to produce a good quality product in the dairy and gets picked up every day and we get paid every month. We don't have to market it, but up here you have to do the marketing and then you have to make sure you get paid. And yeah, it's a whole new ball game.
Developing the north, what would you like to see happen?
Dams. I think we've had quite a few people come have a look what we're doing, and a few people from down south, they want to grow rice or grow other horticultural products. But I say, well, look, there's plenty of country up here. You know, there's red loam on the river and there's floodplain. There's lots of country and there's lots of water, but none of it's captured. So I just think we need dams because, you know, the government talks about infrastructure and I agree with that. But if we can build some dams, we'll get a few people interested. It's a bit like the Ord River. You know, if you took the Ord Dam away, there'd be no Kununurra. It'd be just a little wayside stop.
Bruce White, thanks for coming in from Mount Kembla. We appreciate your time. Bruce White, that's a fair drive too from Mount Kembla, so we really do appreciate his time. Let's quickly go back over to the barbecue. As I mentioned, you can join the conversation here today via the hashtag #IdMoveNorthIf. Carl Curtin's at the hot plate. I can hear the sizzle, Carl. Tell us about some of the reasons people might move up north.
Alyssa says on Twitter, I'd move north if there were better internet and services. Callie says, I'd move north if, that's with the hashtag, I think more would move north if they knew how great it was and if flights to and from were cheaper. And Anonymous has tweeted us, I'd move back if the ex left. Darwin is too small to handle me, him, and the mistress.
There you go. All sorts of reasons to come to the north or maybe stay away. Right across Australia on ABC Local Radio, you're listening to a special broadcast of the Country Hour as part of our celebrations to say happy birthday, happy 70th birthday to Australia's longest-running radio program, the Country Hour. We're here at Crocodilus Park, but I can tell you what, there is more to the top end than crocs and cattle. Fruit and veggies, they play a huge role in the farming landscape up this way. Just down the road, actually, from where we are, we've got Australia's biggest durian farm. Around the corner from that is Australia's biggest dragon fruit farm. We pump out plenty of rambutans, watermelons, Lebanese cucumbers, jackfruit, and, of course, mangoes. Heaps of mangoes up this way. In fact, a couple of years ago, we produced more mangoes in the territory than Queensland. We lost that title last year. But you get what I'm saying. Lots of mangoes up this way. And one of the biggest mango farms in the Northern Territory is owned and run by a lovely lady. And her name is Tu.
Hello. My name is Tu from Tu's Garden. My farm is in Acacia Hills. Been here 20, 3 years now. We start slow, very small, and be very careful, you know, to do what we plan to do. And we expand very slowly and maturely. And learning at the same time where we growing, I think that's a key. You know, you don't grow quick or start big, and then you don't know a few small things might go wrong. And most of the people who start with money seem to, particularly in the farming industry, you know, you cannot throw the money left, right, and center because lots of things can go wrong.
What were some of the big lessons you learned as you grew?
Probably don't leave the farm too often. Don't go away for too long. You know, my friend always said to me, the best fertilizer for the tree is the owner's footstep. So that's why we always stay around and make sure that we pay attention to all the tree we grow.
Well, you do. You work hard. You spend a lot of time on the farm. What do you love about it? What keeps you here?
Be able to feed the world. I think that's what I like the most. And grow what I love. And I love mango. So you grow what you like or what you love to do. And being a farmer, I know it's a hard work, very high commitment. But I do enjoy living the land and knowing that the products that I grow is going to feed, make everyone happy. And when people ask me what you do, and I said, I'm a farmer. And they said, what do you do? What do you farm? And I said, mangoes. All the people smile. So that's a good thing.
Do you think there's room to expand Australia's mango industry?
I really think our industry is not mature yet. We have lots of room to expanding, particularly the export. They haven't been not even 30% of our production's been export. If Darwin can expand a little bit more, we can start export more and make the season for the export like 3 months or 4 months, and the people can be attractive to import some of Australian fruit.
As someone who loves the north of Australia, loves farming here, when you hear federal politicians talking about developing the north, what do you hope that equates to?
I hope that the government serious, not just talk. And if the government serious about it, I'm sure, you know, we would be pleased to see it happen, even though just starting, like infrastructures, telecommunication, export program, you know, labor issues, that as we know, Australian doesn't want to work in the farm. I don't blame them, but very hard to get Australian to work in the farm. So we need the government help us how a labour, as a farming is very labour intensive when it's picking fruit.
And in the case of your crop, it often involves picking in the hottest and sweatiest time of the year. So just finally, too, how is the mango season shaping up this year?
Wow, mangoes shaping up so well, and we start picking some of the Asian variety already. So, and now, as you can see sitting here, we have a full flower. So I know it's a little bit late, but the customer are going to have the best eating mangoes.
All the best for the season. Thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Thank you, Matt, and I appreciate your support.
Two from Two's Garden, originally from Thailand, and running one of the biggest mango farms in the Northern Territory. In front of a crowd of 536 crocodiles and with listeners right around Australia, you're tuning in to a special broadcast of the Country Hour as we celebrate 70 years of Australia's longest-running radio program. We're at Crocodilus Park. But let's turn our attention to beef because the Territory, famous for its cattle industry, those million-acre stations, so big that you need a helicopter just to get the cattle into the yards. This industry, it's now worth something like over $320 million a year. One bloke who, I mean, we've been talking about what would bring you north. Our next guest, originally out of southeast Queensland, moved to the territory in the late 1970s. He started out as a pastures agronomist and animal production officer with a DPI in Katherine, and then went on to become a cattleman himself. He now owns Sunday Creek Station. Tom Stockwell, thanks so much for coming in today. Research, that's what brought you to the north, but you stayed to run your own cattle business. Why?
Oh, well, it was a job that brought me north in the first place, and just after self-government, which was another really enthusiastic and optimistic time in the territory's history. And, well, I got here, it was just great country, great people, and just opportunities here that weren't even available in Queensland at the time. You know, it was just an opportunity. We found an area of land that other people had sort of forsaken, and there was a whole group of young people our age that got into it, and we've sort of, all about 20 of us there, developed family places and got a really successful little cattle district going now.
To get a cattle station on the Sturt Plateau and make it work, has it been easy?
No. It's, I guess it's been a lot of hard work. The timing was lucky. We sort of got in there just before the live export took off. So really, a lot of the northern part of the territory has grown after BTEC with the advent of the live export trade. That's what helped us along. So we had that to go, but we all started with blank canvases there, by and large, and we've just sort of grown steadily and with all the ups and downs that everybody else has faced as well.
You've raised three kids here with your wife, Bev, on the station. They did School of the Air, and then they went off to boarding school after that. A lot of people move at that point. They go with the kids to a capital city. Why did you stay?
Oh, well, it's one of the main reasons. I mean, we wanted to run our own beef cattle place, but we also wanted to raise our kids in the bush. But the idea of boarding school is to give them a chance to see the other side of life and get a decent education, then bring it back to the territory and just continue the growth. So, yeah, that was it. But no, Sunday Creek's home for us.
Are they coming back?
Yeah, we've got our eldest back home for a gap year now, and then she's off to Gatton to study ag science, and we're hoping she comes back up here again after that. But yeah.
Speaking of ag science, you did a lot of research with the DPI around Katherine in the late 70s. Do you sit around sometimes and hear about research being done and think, I did that. I've done it. Why are you doing it again?
There is a certain amount of revolutionary stuff that's with research in the north and development in the north. It goes round and round, but oh no, I think it's fair to say, you know, we did a bit of broad brush stuff back there, and we put some runs on the board. I had a chance to work with some fantastic people while I was doing it. That was half the thing, but there's a lot of good stuff going on now, and the industry needs to keep doing R&D, otherwise we just become less competitive, so we just need to keep getting better all the time.
Mm. These days, you can send your cattle to an abattoir just down the road, care of AA Co. We've got abattoirs down South Australia, Victoria, Queensland, all after your cattle. Live export markets in Indonesia, Vietnam. You might be sending some to China very soon. Has there ever been a better time to run cattle in the north?
Certainly not since 1978 when I arrived. I think, a few years ago we probably hit the pits in terms of where the industry was, and it's taking a long time to climb out of that. But this year is certainly, if this is the start of the develop the north thing, It's a great year because we sent cattle south, west, and north so far. So it's been a really good year for us and for everybody else. So, and I just hope all the pundits are right that it's just the start of it, really.
There's a latest focus on developing the north. What do you hope comes from it?
I hope some longevity comes from it. That it's not just another flash in the pan. But as Graham Webb said, you know that. There does seem to be a bit of commitment to it from both sides of politics down south to make it long-lasting. That's what it needs. And I hope the government puts their money and their efforts into infrastructure and the sorts of rules or lack of rules that enable private industry to come off the back of that and do the investment at the micro level, if you like, as long as the government looks after the stuff that puts the infrastructure here for everybody, if you like.
I know a lot of people up north are sceptical.
Well, it's happened time and time again, but I think, we've got to be optimistic and, we might be remote from 20 million people in southern Australia, but we're a lot closer to half a billion people just to the near north of us. So that's the equation we've got to satisfy, that sort of pull between the remoteness from our southern capitals and population, but that great opportunity that we have to us just to the north.
Thanks for your time on the Country Hour today. Not just today, but over the years.
Thank you, Matt. And can I just say on behalf of the industry just how much we've appreciated the role of the Country Hour over the 30 years that I've been here anyway. It's been great. And I just only wish that the ABC would put a better radio repeater in so that more people in the bush could actually hear the Country Hour.
That message has been received. Thank you very much, Tom Stockwell, right across the country on ABC Local Radio. Listening to a special broadcast of the Country Hour coming from Crocodilus Park, which is on the outskirts of Darwin in the Northern Territory. For everyone in southern states, you will be going back to your normal Country Hour in about sort of 20 minutes' time, and you'll get your local weather. So fear not, your local weather coming up in about 20 minutes' time. And keep the conversation going online through Twitter via that hashtag, #IdMoveNorthIf. We're getting some beauties coming through. We'll go through a few more of them in just a moment. And all the barbecue work has been done by Carl. Geez, we'll get an update on how the Brahmin has fared on the hot plate in a moment as well. I'd move north if. Well, I can tell you one of the reasons I moved up north was the thought of catching that elusive barramundi. And then when you catch one, you want to catch a meter barramundi. When you're part of the meter club in the north of Australia, that's when you can really strut around town. Barra fishing. It draws hopeless fishermen like myself in their thousands to the north every year. It's really good tourism dollars, but I'll tell you what, it's the aquaculture industry, which could soon be seeing the most growth. You might have heard about plans to build what will probably be the biggest prawn farm in the world out at Lejeune Station on the WANT border. And we've also got here in the Territory Australia's biggest barramundi farm. That's out at Humpty Doo. It's been operating for 22 years. It's a family-run operation. Pumps out, well, Dan Richards from Humpty Doo Barramundi is with me. It pumps out now how many tonnes a year?
We're turning out about 1,500 tonnes a year at the moment.
My goodness. You're a fifth-generation Territorian.
My children are, yes.
Your children are fifth generation. Mm. I'm guessing that's pretty rare for a white fella.
Very uncommon for white folk in this state.
Yeah.
Territory.
Tell me how you've gone about building a family business into the biggest barramundi farm in Australia.
I think I really echo Tu's message earlier, Matt. We started our operation in a very modest at a very modest scale, very small. We learnt our lessons on a small scale. We didn't have any money, so that caused us to do things in economical and efficient ways. And then when we got it right, we committed to a long learning journey. Once we got it right, we've scaled it up. And so we've grown 600% in the last 8 years.
Wow. What was the turning point?
We've acquired knowledge over time, you know, yep. just a series. It's like pieces of the puzzle. You've got to get every piece of the puzzle right. And so we've just worked on one thing after another. We've got a relentless commitment to improvement in all elements, whether it's the production systems or the quality of the product or the service to the customers. We're just working on one thing after another to get it better. And we've got a big list of things we'd like to improve in the future as well.
Are you planning to expand even further?
Yeah, we've got plans afoot at the moment for expansion, yes.
Where do you send your barra?
So at the moment we service the Australian domestic market, so we've got twice a week shipments to all mainland capitals, and so we sell through wholesalers and retailers around the country.
Export market?
At the moment we're just domestic market focused. For us to develop into export, we've got a few things we need to ducks we've got to get it lined up before we can go into that space.
Yeah, is that the next frontier though for you guys?
We believe there's significant opportunity within the Australian domestic market first, probably dipping the toe in the water in the international market would be a good place to start, but we're probably not turning the ship in that direction at this stage.
Do you feel that demand is outstripping the supply right now?
There is demand for product there is demand out there if you can get your systems together to be able to supply it. The demand's there.
Yeah. working with your family. Your dad's a good friend of the country, ours. What's that like, and how do you make it work so that your business improves?
We're all very different personalities. I think that's probably fair to say. And I think it's about making the most of the strengths of each person. You know, Dad is a extremely ethical person. He's a great visionary in terms of where the thing can go. I like to focus on implementation. So let's get it down to what we can do, and I'll have to get stuck in and actually do it.
And for all of our listeners in the southern parts of Australia today, for you, what are the tips on how to grow and run a successful agribusiness in the north?
I think it's probably like anywhere. I think two pretty well nailed it, you know, is to start small, learn your business really well, and then grow it from there, and pay attention to the details.
Have you caught a meter barra?
Out of the farm? I probably have. We've been getting some stonkers out of there recently, up to 10 kilos. But to tell the truth, I'm a much better fish farmer than I am a barra fisherman.
And you get crocodiles wandering in every now and then into the farm as well.
We sure do. We've got a crocodile exclusion fence along the Adelaide River.
And if you catch one, they end up here at Crocodiles Farm where we're broadcasting.
They sure do, yeah. A number of our crocodiles over the years have found their way and live out the rest of their days here at Crocodilus.
Wow. Hey, Dan, thanks so much for coming along and having a chat to the Country Hour.
It's a pleasure, Matt.
This is part of a special broadcast going right across the country.
Hello, my name's Rebecca Cadso. I'm from Mount Riddick Station, 200 kilometres northeast of Alice Springs. We run around 8,000 cattle and we send beef both domestically and internationally all over the world. I'd like to see more investments in roads, definitely roads, and better transport for our cattle. I'd also like to see better communications, more mobile outlets and hotspots in remote areas. You're listening to a special broadcast of the Country Hour from the Northern Territory.
You are, and plenty of people will join the conversation online via Twitter and the hashtag I'd Move North If. Carl Curtin at the barbecue. What are some of our best I'd Move North Ifs?
The hashtag's working both on Facebook at ABC Rural and on Twitter. Joanna says, I don't want anyone to move north. Too many people will ruin it for us. Matthew says, cheaper housing in Darwin will do.
Mm.
Duncan, all I need is a job, and I'll be back in a heartbeat.
Beautiful. Join the conversation on Twitter with the hashtag I'd Move North If. We've been talking barra, we've been talking cattle and crocs. Another industry that is really emerging in the north of Australia right now is forestry. If we start in Katherine, there's a bit over 2,000 hectares of Indian sandwood there right now. Move a bit further north to the Douglas Daly region, there's another 1,500 hectares of Indian sandalwood, and you've got Australia's largest plantation of mahogany trees. So, for as far as the eye can see, future floorboards over 12,000 hectares. And then, further north, a really special project. You've got to get yourself to Darwin, jump in a little plane, and you head across to the Tiwi Islands. And on those islands are 30,000 hectares of acacia mangum trees. They're the trees that you mash up and turn into paper. So it's an island full of future A4 reams of paper, acacia mangums. Now, these plantations, they've had a really checkered history. They've had plenty of ups and downs. But these days, the plantations are completely owned by the traditional owners of those islands. It's the indigenous people of the Tiwis in control. And this year, a really special moment, the first harvest. The first harvest happened, and for people like Elder Gibson Farmer, as you can imagine, a special moment given that he actually hand planted some of those trees.
I feel really proud, and like what me and Sue, you know, we've been around with forestry, so we need our people to see. It's very important for us and my people, especially the young generation that are coming up. We need to get them off welfare and get a job.
And there's lots of young people here today. What do you think this industry could mean for them?
Well, it's an eye-opener for them. It's an eye-opener for them so they can see what we're doing on the ground. You know, like, instead of they're hearing story from somebody else, it's right in front of their eyes.
And did you think you'd ever see this day?
I thought I'm not going to see this day, but now Lucky I brought my grandkids too. My grandkids, they see what's been happening and they see what I've been doing all my life. So now, very important for us to see what's happening on the ground.
Is there a few more foresters in your family to come, Gibbo?
Well, I got about four boys.
Four boys, yeah.
Four grandsons. I got three granddaughters here. I got four. That's why I encourage more my young grandkids to come to work.
Yep.
And look after the land and environment.
Enjoy the day. Thanks for being on the Country Hour.
Yeah, right, mate. Thank you.
Gibson Farmer, traditional owner on the Tiwi Islands, a forester, a proud man. And those wood chips, they're due to be shipped out of the Tiwis over the next month or so to Asian pulp mills. Developing the North, that's what we're talking about here today on the Country Hour from Darwin as we broadcast right across the country. This idea of developing the North, as we've heard from quite a few people, it's been mentioned before, but gee, it really is back in the headlines this year.
The North's time has come. There's no doubt about it, the North's time has come.
The challenge is to build on the strengths of our great North, not just for the benefit of people living in Northern Australia, but for the benefit of every single Australian.
We know that when Northern Australia is strong, so is our continent. And therefore, the investments being made in the North are good for the country as a whole.
Any money that's outlaid or any scheme that's initiated should be with bipartisan agreement.
Developing Northern Australia needs to be across all three states. It needs federal government's funding support, and it's a good thing.
We understand there are some economic powerhouses to our north. There's enormous market and trade opportunities, and it's up to us to ensure that we get on with the job of enabling business to be able to service those opportunities.
Yes, developing the north. It's in the headlines this year, care of a white paper and the promise of millions of dollars to be spent on roads and water infrastructure. My next guest is Ian Baker, who's been involved in top-end farming since the early 1980s. He's been an ag scientist with the government, then a mango farmer. He's now an industry consultant. Ian, the current federal government talk about developing the north. Have we seen this all before, or is there something different going on?
There's something different this time, mate. I think we ought to thank the police. Definitely they're focusing. Look, I think there's a lot more substance this time, as Tom Stockwell said. And it's both parties, and I don't think it's a flash in the pan.
What's the substance?
Well, I think that's up to us in the industry much more. We can't, police come and go, but us in the industry need to stand up and take a stronger leadership position, as the cattlemen are doing. And I know our mob, the mango farmers, and are saying, look, we need to focus, us in industry, we're the ones who keep staying here. Police come and go, bureaucrats come and go, we're here for a long time.
So the people that are here, though, what do they need to help grow the north?
Oh, I think Dan said it, and Tu said it, and it's about thinking about giving yourself time to learn when you come here. Don't come in and rush in with a massive big scheme. Our history has been start big, go small. There's lots of successful farmers whose story isn't told, who started small, like Tu, like Dan, and now quite big. I think about all the Vietnamese farmers in the top end here who started with nothing, no money, no English, didn't know anything, were actually not farmers. And now that's quite a big sector. And so they started small and give themselves time to learn. I suppose fundamentally, though, it's focusing on this markets and economics. That's really the driver. We've got to keep the focus on markets and economics. How can we make a quid?
You mentioned the Vietnamese growers who are hugely successful in Darwin's rural area. Tell us the story about what they did decades ago when it came to markets.
So you talk to them and they come here with no English, no money. How did you buy the first bag of fertiliser, Mindo or any of them? There's probably 100 of them now up here. And they said, look, Ian, you know, the bloke in the market, Brisbane market, told me, here's a block of land I can go and farm. Here's some money to buy the fertiliser and I'll buy the crop back off you. So basically it was a development funded by the marketplace. So I'm a bit sceptical. I think we rely too much on what government's going to do. I'm more about what can we do in the private sector. There is land, there is water. We've got to start thinking about markets and economics. But I think the business models are really important. As Dan said and Tu said, don't rush in too quick. Start small, grow big. That's what all of our guys, all of the success of mangoes, melons, Asian veg, and as Dan said, Start small, grow big.
Do you feel there is a crop that has room for great expansion in the north?
I think we can grow lots of things. I think, you know, definitely around peanuts, cotton, mung beans, chickpeas. I think long grain, aromatic rice, I think, has got a lot of opportunity. So there's a number of crops, and we know we can grow those things. The problem is getting the economics right on the farm. And it's interesting, we ran Food Futures Conference last year that you were involved with, and we brought some Indonesians over. And then Indonesians said, we said to them, oh, we've just started to think about cropping in this part of the world as irrigation and two crops a year. And, of course, the Indonesians have been doing that for 500 years. For the people who come from south, that's actually, they don't understand you do two crops in this environment because it's always warm. So I think that's probably one of the big transitions. Once we get into some of these commodity crops and grow two crops a year, like they do in Indonesia, like they do in most of the tropics, I think that's probably a big part of the question in terms of solving the economic question.
Now you look at the ord and there's no double cropping there, really.
Correct. Mm. That's correct. And I think the ord's really grown around melons. It's a melon industry that got it going. But I think, you know, the question is, in what areas can we start to look at double cropping?
Yeah. Standing next to you, Ian, is Jan Hintz, who has lived and farmed in the Top End, I think it's for over 35 years now, Jan.
Something like that, yeah.
Former Rural Woman of the Year, former mango and rambutan grower, and nowadays into the cut flower industry. Why flowers?
Well, I've been growing flowers for nearly 25 years now. It was the Department of Primary Industry up here who introduced me to it as a possibility. And we went for it and was decided that having a crop that you harvest every year, although it's a bit like dairy farming and you've got to get out of bed every day, it makes for a nice cash flow. So you don't put all your eggs in one basket like with some of the fruit crops where if you harvest a crop, that's fantastic, but sometimes you don't.
Or if you get a disease, it knocks you right out.
Absolutely. Or if a cyclone comes through and blows all the fruit off the trees and this and that. So we've been through a few vicissitudes, so to speak, with some of the fruit trees, and we thought, no, flowers are pretty good. And it's a beautiful crop to grow, and it's a beautiful crop to sell. You're selling happiness to people. And that's nice.
It's colourful.
It's colourful. It's spectacular.
Flowers need to be fresh. How do you get them to markets?
We air freight them down, and unfortunately that's been one of the major handicaps the industry has had. They're quite heavy. Heliconias and gingers are what we grow, and they are quite solid type flowers, and they weigh quite a bit. So you find that by the time you get into the market, you're adding a fair chunk of actual just air freight onto your wholesale cost, landed in Brisbane or Sydney or Melbourne or wherever.
Yeah.
So we've had a bit of problems with the air freight going out of here. The prices of it have gone quite astronomical, and it's made it very, very difficult. And, in fact, I don't think there's much going out now at all. There's two or three other growers who I don't export anymore, but there's two or three other growers who are sending flowers down south still. But it's not easy. And the local airlines say, well, we're not freight carriers, we're people carriers, so you don't have any leg to stand on with negotiations there.
We're about to run out of time, Jan.
What a pity.
It's hot up here. We've got a lot of people on the Twitter saying it's too hot, it's too humid. There's cyclones, there's bugs. We're a long way from markets. Why do you farm up here?
Well, I like the heat, so that's a bit of a start. We haven't had a decent cyclone in a long time, so touch wood, we're not going to have another one soon. It's a beautiful place to live. It's lovely country, great people. And so many opportunities, not just with the flowers that I grow, but so many other horticultural crops. It's just a fantastic place to operate. And
do you want to see the north developed and more people up here?
Well, it's sort of a bit old-fashioned to say, nah, let's keep it a secret. We won't let them come up here. They don't appreciate it half the time. But this is not true. It is great to see people wanting to come up here and have a hand in the future of the Top End of Australia.
Thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour today and coming along to help us celebrate 70 years. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Jan Hintz. Cut Flowers is the business now, but over 35 years done all sorts of things in the Top End of Australia. That's it today from Crocodilus Park in the Northern Territory. Wherever you are across the nation, I hope you've enjoyed the broadcast. A special shout out to those on the outskirts of Gunnedah at AgQuip Field Days tuning in. You can keep up to date with rural news wherever you are via our website at ABC Rural. A big thanks to Captain Carl Curtin for all the work he's done, not only in the barbecue, but all behind the scenes work, and also to Matt O'Sullivan. I'll leave you with this little piece of advice from a good mate of mine. He always reckons, keep it rural.
You're listening to The Country Hour with Matt Brann on ABC Local Radio right across the Territory.
We've just lost our national audience. They've gone back to their own country hours. So it's just us Territorians. It's just us again. And the pen next to me of 536 crocodiles. I hope we did well. I hope they enjoyed it. I hope if they were picking apples in Tassie or sowing some wheat in WA, I hope they enjoyed it. Big thanks to all the people who made the trip to Crocodilus Park and to share their Northern Territory story. All this talk about Northern development, I wonder how you feel about it. Certainly it's been in the headlines, hasn't it, because of that white paper that was released, and there's millions of dollars committed to the North to be spent on roads, water infrastructure, on research, all that sort of thing. So the money's there, but what is actually happening on the ground? We've heard all the talk, we've seen the papers, but what's actually happening on the ground? It's a question that I put to Luke Bowen, who is the General Manager of the North Australian Development Office.
So, Matt, this is the time where, you know, we know how government works. Government puts out a policy, puts out a plan. We've had the white paper hit the ground a few weeks ago. An agriculture white paper hit the ground as well, about the same time. So now we're in that stage where the work's about to start. It's been in theory to some extent, but we know that developing Northern Australia hasn't started, isn't going to start tomorrow. It's been happening for the last 150 years. This is about government getting better organised. It's about government and industry and those who are prepared to have a crack longer term getting better organised, and also changing the psyche nationally.
So when are we going to see the work, and what's it going to look like?
So we're already seeing some of the road priorities, for example. Sure, a bucket of money which has got to get bigger over time, but $700 million effectively identified in the white paper up front for beef roads and for other infrastructure across the north, road infrastructure across the north, $500 million for water infrastructure, for research around agricultural systems and water use and all the rest of it. You know, there's probably about $1.5 billion there ready to go, which is starting to trickle onto the ground. But you've got to have some mechanisms to also to spend that and prioritise it. So the federal government have decided to put an office in Northern Australia, in Darwin, the head office, with the three states, which is still under negotiation, feeding into that office so that we can start working out who's going to get the chop at this, right, where we're going to distribute the money, who's going to get what, because this is a long game. This is not about deciding over the next couple of years what's happening. This has to be a long game. This has to be something that becomes standard operating procedure for governments across the north, governments federally, but certainly business, because at the end of the day, this stuff doesn't happen without business, people getting on the ground and doing it, and keeping on doing what they've been doing, it starting to do it better, starting to be better coordinated, getting government supporting business, getting out of the way so that we can get things done.
Almost $500 million for water infrastructure projects. When are we going to see a dam, a weir, or a bore nominated?
Yeah, well, I think that the interesting thing about water is we know that there's not a lot of dam sites in the north, and we've got high evaporation rates and all those sorts of things. So if you're going to have a dam site, it's got to be a damn good one. But there's a lot of other ways of skinning the cat. Yeah. You know, we know that underground water, aquifer recharge, peak water flows off rivers where you're capturing peak flows and using them more effectively, storing it more effectively, whether it's underground or wherever. We've got to be smarter about water use and capturing it and using it at the right time. So there's a lot more research still to be done.
So the money just sits there waiting?
Oh, well, I think there's money ready to go in relation to research. Some of that stuff's happening. Research into aquifers, recharge, you know, more smart ways of storing water. That's already happening. So this is adding value to what's already taking place.
Yeah, because $500 million, how many dams or weirs do you get for that kind of money?
Yeah, I think if you went down to the shopping centre and bought one off the shelf, depending where it is, you know, you're probably not going to get a great deal. You know, might get a dam or something. So this is about making a start. And clearly, it's a great way that we've seen for the first time, certainly in recent history, in the last century, we're actually seeing something follow the rhetoric. So there's a commitment, there's money there. It's a start. But let's make sure that we make it part of the national psyche that this goes on. It's a long game.
And Darwin
is now the place if you want to do a big project in Northern Australia. You come to this office in Darwin, do you?
So there's a number of initiatives which are structural things about actually putting things in place to make sure that there's a mechanism for dealing with prioritisation across the north, also making a single point of entry for those coming into Northern Australia to get access to the right information, get to the ground quickly, and have some of the procedures cleared so they can get a clear line of sight to where they want to go. Investors, landowners, whoever it is, get them to the table early. So there's a number of things being put in place to make sure that we're not going to put too many blockages in front of people across the road. And these are things that government can do, being smart about it, but while also maintaining the things that are really special to the north. I mean, most of the things that we love in Northern Australia about the unique environment, the unique environmental values, cultural values, those things are very special and they're our competitive advantage. So what we do in Northern Australia is critical that we maintain those things which make us special, including lifestyle. And this is not just about economics, this is about people. At the end of the day, it's about people. It's about people living, growing families, starting businesses, running businesses, and it's part of a broader region, which is the region that we are in, which is that Southeast Asian region, rapidly growing region. The opportunities are immense, and we have to be a part of it. But we've got to do it in the right way and be sensible about it.
That's Luke Bowen. He is the General Manager of the North Australian Development Office. Here on the Country Hour, broadcasting right across the territory, it's 5 minutes to two. Tom Stockwell is back here, and we really appreciate having him on the show today because he's had to fly to get here. You've spent the week in Canberra as part of Canberra Week, talking to the big pollies. What was said and what was achieved?
Well, yes, there was a delegation of the NTCA executive went down and just to do the rounds around Parliament House, if you like, to try and put a bit more structure about what develop the north's going to be for us, and just to make sure that they weren't forgetting the territory, but really, and it was about talking about our issues, about getting some better money for roads going here. We had some particular issues around the poor service that the NBN's providing through the satellite at the moment. We met with any number of politicians about the Tennant Creek radar, which is an issue that's not going to go away until they put a new radar in Tennant Creek, and
how was that received when you've mentioned the Tennant Creek weather radar? The NTCA is not happy about it. How was that received?
The parliamentary secretary responsible for the Bureau of Meteorology couldn't find the time to meet with us, but we met with a number of our local members and senators and other people from North Australia. We went to the Prime Minister's office, and we've got some more. You know, it's still going. You know, it's not a fight we're going to drop. So,
okay.
Everybody except the Bureau of Meteorology and the Parliamentary Secretary for the Bureau of Meteorology is incredulous that they've made this decision. So it's a fight that will be ongoing.
Yeah. Hey, just finally, about our barbecue here today, we managed to track down some Brahman steak. It's hard to find in the territory unless you own a cattle station.
Well, that's true, but the steak you've had here today comes from Gunbalunya Abattoir.
Aha, yes.
Out in Arnhem Land, it's great. And now that the AACo job's coming up, so hopefully in the near future it will be easier to find.
Do you feel we're quickly getting to a point that you can go into a restaurant in Darwin and order a top-end T-bone or something?
I'd like to see it go a lot further than that. I look forward to the day when the local butchers can do service kills, or we've got a product coming back, because certainly there's enough production systems in the territory now that can turn out a really good quality grass-fed animal, tasty, tastes like the north, and the NTCA had a stand at a barbecue running at the Darwin show, and the response from local people when they knew it was a local beef, and also that it came from an indigenous operation at Gunbalunya, it was just, you know, the response was terrific. So there's no doubt that the Territorians would love to eat more territory beef, so I look forward to the day when we can actually supply the domestic market as well as all the overseas and interstate markets.
Are you happy with how Carl cooked it?
Oh, I could. There's a few things you could learn about cooking beef.
Oh, Carl, that's a shame. Hey, thanks so much for coming along today, Tom. Really appreciate it. Tom Stockwell from Sunday Creek Station. He's also the president these days of the NT Cattlemen's Association. Well, that wraps up a busy, busy country hour. Hope you've enjoyed it. We've heard from some sensational people today, and interesting to get their thoughts on northern development. You can catch all of our stories online when you go searching for NT Country Hour. I'll catch you tomorrow. It's Friday. Where's the week gone? Keep it rural.